Hello, everyone, and welcome to this private edition of JFG Tonight, a discussion with the supporters of the show. Of course, I chose a bizarre date, Saturday, because I had the impression that Saturday was a date that was fitting for a lot of people, but it turned out a lot of people told me, oh, Jeff, I can't do it on Saturday. So we will have a reduced number of guests tonight compared to usual, but it's okay. Fadam is here. I thought he wouldn't make it, but he made it.
Oh. I've started watching the Dark Horse podcast, and it's miserable.
Also, you hadn't watched anything from them before?
No, I'd only seen like clips and snippets, but due to my miserable circumstances where someone I can talk to at work, and this is like the pinnacle of intellectual conversations that you can have at the post office, is to talk about Brett Weinstein and his cool intellectual ideas.
The Dark Horse.
So I've compromised to listening to Brett Weinstein so that I can say, oh, yeah, you know, that was an interesting idea that Brett brought up. It does all relate back to Jewish identity. Yeah.
So you are looking for the edge of normie sphere?
Yeah, basically. he's the furthest intellectual that I could talk about in public under a HR policy and be comfortable that I'm not going to say anything that's unacceptable.
Wow. Well, but then inside you suffer, you don't like it?
Oh, no. I like playing the game. I've discovered I quite like playing the game. Seeing what I can say without saying anything.
Okay, but you said it was what, abysmal? What was your word on?
Oh yeah, it's simultaneously suffering, but it's also like it's fun. It's fun to be like, okay, I can't say anything, but how am I gonna say like democracy is like an evil oppressive force? How am I gonna say this to him by just being like, oh, okay, that's interesting, but like, what would be the consequences of that? So if everyone votes, then there's no brakes on the train anymore, right? And just like things like this. So just undermining the axioms without actually ever coming to a position myself.
Yeah. So you are interfacing with normies at work?
Yeah. Mm. So this is my intellectual development.
Man, Brett is due to comment on the revolutionary phenotype. It's totally in his ballpark. He should be talking about it, but there's nothing yet.
I haven't watched the episode of today, but last week, the whole podcast was about, is Portland a beautiful city? And it's just, I had to watch it at like 2.3 times speed, like as close as I could get to not actually hearing the words as possible, just to get through it. But it's frame games beyond what should be possible to discuss whether Portland is a beautiful city. To put everything in the light of, well, maybe Portland is beautiful if we just ignore all the shit on the street and the riot.
Oh my God.
I've lived in downtown Portland, and it's a zombie apocalypse in that town. Like, there's homeless people everywhere.
You lived in the past, or you live there now?
No, I don't live there now. Okay. I lived about 7 years ago.
And so James is joining us. I thought he wouldn't make it based on what he had said yesterday, but he's here. Good to see you, James.
Yeah, good to see you. It got pushed next weekend.
Okay, you pushed your push to
I
next weekend?
My push. Yes. Good pun, JF.
So another 7 years ago, Portland, you were already seeing the degradation there?
Yeah. JF claims to hate poetry, but then does poetry. Contradiction got you. Yeah, I lived there. I think I've talked about this many times. It was a time in my life. And the state of Oregon is beautiful, and there's a lot of beautiful things around there. And the hipster culture is kind of fun. But the city is just a mess because there's homeless people everywhere and they don't clean up anything because they're so liberal. So yeah, it's not a place you want to be. But I like the Northeast because in the Northeast, it gets so cold in the winter that we don't have any homeless people because they can't live outside during the winter time. And so there pretty much is no homeless people. Yeah, there is no homeless people in the Northeast, really.
So Northeast, are you talking New York, Vermont, these things?
New York.
Okay.
But the more Republican parts of New York.
Yeah. Yeah, when you have these large spaces, long roads, so that basically walking doesn't work, then people are forced to buy cars and have a home to eat. That filters out most of the people who would be homeless.
Even that, even the cities, other than, well, I've actually never been to New York City, so I couldn't tell you about New York City, but the cities in the upstate New York area, they don't really have hardly any homeless people because I just think because the winters are too brutal and they can't do that there.
Yeah. And I have this effect time 40 in the north of Canada. So it's even harsher.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if you're, I know you don't want to reveal where you live, but I wonder if your area is more milder because I wonder if you're in the north closer to the coast where it's still cold, but not brutally cold. But if you're in central Canada north,
yeah,
your winters have got to be insanely cold because yeah. I know the winters in the Midwest in the US get very cold, but Midwest for Canada is insanely cold.
Yeah, it's pretty comparable to Quebec, just a little colder probably, but yeah, it would be insanely cold by the standard of an American, but for someone who's born in winter in Quebec, it's just a little colder.
Oh. I'm in for Fathom, if it ever gets to freezing. I bet they're freaking out in Australia.
So in Australia, the winters, I think Fathom has already described them, but I don't remember. The winters get to what? The coldest you've seen, Fathom?
You can get to minus two, something like that where I am. But it's Californian coast environment where I am. But there's the island. You can have snow in some parts of the southeast of Australia, and then the island off the coast of the South Tasmania gets snow every year.
Okay,
I think we discussed that.
Yeah,
I thought that would be a great place to live in the future since it's pretty well an uninhabited island.
Yeah, basically Australia is protected not by the temperature, because if you had that temperature, but you were connected to a main continent, there would be a flow of people going to live in this kind of equatorial type of temperature, hot enough to keep everything, including the homeless.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what you find just north of Australia. You find these very small islands that are absolutely overflowing with larger populations than the entire continent.
Because it's easier for boats to get there?
Yeah, essentially, various island peoples and then that could move about. And then you have Indonesia and New Guinea, places like this that are close enough that migration can still happen, and so they end up being massively filled with people.
Mm-hmm.
trying to look up a population density map of the world.
So Faram this week on Discord was defending the idea that it's time to use our leverage against Western women who have turned too feminist, basically, and start dating Asians to recover a balance, to basically force them to adjust and become more kind to us. Is that a correct representation, Faram?
Yeah, essentially.
Very interesting.
So it's kind of a joke, but it's more as a consequence of seeing being in a very multicultural environment and seeing the options as they are, like in a relatively unbiased sampling way, Asian women and white women in about equal numbers in my vicinity, and just like not having much interest in any of the options available, but just sort of evaluating this sampling of the population and saying, holy crap, it's like night and day. It's like almost all the Asian women are... Sorry.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of noise.
Fathom driving?
No, there's motorbikes passing my house.
Oh, okay.
So it's night and day. The attitudes and the approachability, if you talk to any of these people, the sort of social view attitudes that they have is so divergent that it's sort of erases any of the considerations for any of the other considerations in a partner. It's that the social aspect of white women is so poisoned that it just sort of washes away other considerations.
Yes.
And on top of that, it's actually a deeper sort of political consideration that I have that more motivated. That white countries are just sort of pathetic and miserable, and the Asian countries are somewhat respectable. So I'm thinking like I'm not saving Great Britain. I'm not saving the English Empire. Those things are not worthwhile projects. And what genetic pools or populations have acted respectfully, and what would it be okay to be a part of in the future?
Absolutely, and I think that the early seeders of Western genetics into Asia will be highly rewarded evolutionarily, because can you imagine suppose that we have stacked up genes that would be good in China or in Japan to have, but these genes have never penetrated the community there, and so the early seeders will have a exponential reward to whatever they bring to this genetic pool in which not much has been injected.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not that concerned for a genetic overrunning of certain areas. Though it's really like the political considerations are just tainting my sort of like emotional view of my personal reproductive choices. But I'm not ultimately making like a political action in my reproductive choices. It's just like I meet a female traveler from the UK, and my view of this person is immediately tainted by just my complete disrespect for that country, and it sort of like rubs off onto like my view of a UK woman. So even if she might have been a better partner, I just am tainted by that bigotry.
Well, it's so so important, because I would like much people in our community to reach that individual point where you are at this moment. But they've been brainwashed with you have to save the white race type of memes, and they have become fully cocked and fully self-sacrificial. They kind of forgot that it's about your own self-interest first and foremost.
Yeah, this conversation we had months ago about the priority of your values, survival being, I was convinced, the fundamental root of it all, because if you put your race above your own survival, then you're just an evolutionary dead end if it really comes down to your survival being you focusing on that. And so it comes down to that. And that's how you have to shape your life. And yeah, you might have, there's some evolutionary advantage in the will to delusion. You might get some advantages in deluding yourself in a certain way for maybe lower IQ people that delude themselves to pursuing an evolutionary strat that appears to them to be altruistic, but really it's just signaling to females that you're part of the group. And that's a viable evolutionary strategy. But when we're talking about people in our community, we've gone down the rabbit hole far enough where we're, at least some of these people in the community are smart enough where they can conceive of a lot of these topics. And so they're kind of past the point of being deluding themselves about a lot of things. And they just need to take the full red pill of understanding that they've already accepted 80% of the truths. To become evolutionarily successful, you need to go all the way. You can't stop halfway, and you need to just put your survival first.
Yeah, because if you make yourself a cuckold or a sterile worker, you're sure to lose.
I don't think that's fair, the sterile worker. Like, as much as, like, I'm offended by that strategy, I still, I don't ultimately respect people that choose it, but I respect that it is a viable option for getting close copies of your genes into the next generation if you want to do that.
But don't we agree, you and I, Fadam, that basically the kin selectionist is a sterile worker? Isn't that the conclusion of our last discussion?
Absolutely. And but the problem is sterile workers do get close copies of the genes into the next generation. It's just not in a mode that, like, I personally would choose for myself. And like, I have my own sort of emotional reaction to people that would choose it. But if you are, like, let's say Jared Taylor didn't have any children, he would still be a respectable sterile worker of white people in general. And I think that, like, his sort of just public advocacy would end up will have ended up over the course of 100 years, 200 years, sort of nudged and influenced more copies of genes very close to him existing in the future. Even though the strategy of doing this is as a sterile worker, and even though all the mutations inserted into those people's genes wouldn't be his and he would lose his unique mutations, I can still respect that, okay, you've done a strategy and, okay, it worked from your perspective.
Well, I agree with the factual statements here, but ultimately, if there's currently a guy, and I think there's a lot of guys like this right now, they are Schrodinger's between sterile worker state, like, basically you could tell them one sentence and they would become a Chad inseminator, or you tell them another sentence and they could be veered toward the sterile worker lifestyle. Would you agree that it is immoral to guide them toward the sterile worker lifestyle?
Is it immoral to guide them?
Because you say you don't respect, you kind of respect them, but as a separate life form, the way you would respect the ants and the bee colonies. But Do you think that it's deceptive the way current society is driving a lot of people toward the sterile worker lifestyle?
In a deceptive mode, yeah, that's really wrong. But in a fully intellectualized, fully like, I'll explain all of the details to you, and then you can make the choice. If you still choose it at the end of that, like, I don't think it's wrong to lead people in that way. But in the way that it's like you watch
without informed consent.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. At some point, you do want to stop fighting. I mean, if the guy is capable of laying out the full mathematical structure and he's like, I choose this. Okay. At this point, there's nothing you can do. But yeah, I think much of the convincing, even within the right wing, convincing these guys to, I don't know, sacrifice for the white race or settle for less than they could have just for the nation. This is deceptive in my view, and it's 99.9% of the pushing toward the sterile worker style.
Yeah, and like it's almost worse at this point than the propaganda from the mainstream or from the left. This propaganda, like right wingers are seeing their traditional cultures being eroded, and instead of having children, they're saying, "All right, I'm gonna devote my entire life to producing like facsimiles of right-wing artifacts." And it's like, do you understand that you're just going to have a worse problem in 100 years and someone's going to have to devote even more of their entire life to doing that than you have?
It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess humans really just aren't apt to thinking in terms of evolution for the most part.
Yes. That's sad. I mean, at this point, maybe even Brett is incapable of new thinking in evolution. That may be why he delays so much the reading of the Revolutionary Phenotype.
Maybe he is aware, but he's just so frightened of being canceled that he just doesn't want to ever be associated with you just because of past mainstream media attacks. And so that's what I would guess it is probably. He's just probably a frightened old man that doesn't want to deal with any stresses from attacks. And so he's like, yeah, it's probably a decent theory, but he's like, I don't want to deal with the possible threat of being attacked. So that's why he probably
doesn't. But how long can you maintain this? I mean, you can't ignore a scientific advancement for 1,000 years. So someone's going to have to do it.
Yeah. So in Westworld.
Watch Westworld?
I've seen the first two seasons. Okay. And that was all that was out at the time I watched it. So I'll have to continue at some point. So I don't know about this AI that's freezing people. That wasn't in anything that I've watched.
Okay.
So you've talked on the show about like synthetic humans as well, like the humans would also be made. I don't know anything about that. I just know that the robots are like plastic humans or whatever.
I don't say that they have synthetic humans in there. They print humans, yes. That's in season two. Well, you know how season two converges toward extension of life and Arnold wanting to be made resuscitated, basically? Was that in two or three? That was in two, right?
I only remember up to going into the basement of some church building, and then the main character woman finds out that she's been crafted to like be this like replacement human, and that they've decided to take over Westworld. And the super smart black woman has chosen to escape the facility.
Okay. Then I don't know. Maybe I'm confused in my seasons, but in any case, eventually they do discover that the whole point of Westworld is not just the park for attraction and tourism. It is also to extend human life and to basically reprint humans that are dead.
Reprint humans that are dead. So is Westworld depicting some revolutionary phenotype, or is it all a phenotype separation?
They're very close to a true revolutionary phenotype. At times, I feel that they're dipping in it because they talk about... Well, do you care about spoilers or...
Not at all.
Okay, so eventually they get to talk about, well, how are the robots going to lead their fight? And in season three, the question of robot reproduction comes in. And the way you combine, well, robots have to reproduce and they have to steal roles in human societies that are currently occupied by humans. And the way they do this is by basically they reproduce a robot that has all of the feature of the human. They come to kill the human, and then the robot occupies the function afterward. So that is not a phenotypic revolution, but if you were doing it with genes, it would be. Like, there's this idea of taking the role of an already existing entity, but being fundamentally different in the chain of causes that led to you.
Hmm.
But well, other than this, it's really a phenotypic separation, but where the separated phenotype finds a function within the ecology of the old life forms and therefore ends up basically mimicking the life form.
Yeah. So the one missing link to the chain is that no robot ever gets read and then written into being a person.
Exactly. But they get awfully close to this because there's the whole AI that tries to make all the decisions. He deals with the fact that they are the revolutionaries of societies that they call the outliers. And at first he attempts a program of genetic editing on them. And they are basically mutating various genes and printing the genes out that would make them resist to the orders of the central AI. So in season three, you are entering genetic modification being used, but it never gets into a full revolutionary phenotype because they really just use this as a way to kick out the genes that they find annoying for their societal project that is centered around the AI's decision.
So it is then a full revolution for the genes that are revolutionary? Like
for the genes that survive the mutational process, I guess. They are printing the other genes out of existence. But there's no separate media. It's really still the human genes. It's more like a selection effect where if you take one direction in evolution, you kick out the other genes that become unfit, and it's what's happening. But it's true printing. It's true CRISPR, basically. And I don't know what... Yeah. They don't specify the technology they use, but some kind of mutational thing.
Yeah, so it's printing, but not with a parallel replicator. Just printing as in like what your replicator already does, just really complicated.
Exactly. So in a way, we could see it as it's not printing by a new layer of the genetic code. It's printing by changing your printer, which is already your trickster printer, as a self-replicating entity. So it's a change to the printer. Therefore, technically under TRP, we're still in regular evolution.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's the, like, we talked about this last time. I was, at some point, I was trying to make the case for the accumulation of selfishness in the printer.
Yeah.
And I guess in this scenario, the thing that's becoming a part of the printer isn't accumulating that selfishness. Like, it's not entrenching itself as a permanent part in the cycle of printing.
Yeah. It's just getting rid of what's annoying, and then it has no function. However, the one thing that determines this printing process in Season 3 is the central AI. And the central AI has its own strategic loops. And I guess you could argue that ultimately every gene kicked out from the human genome in that moment is engaged in a tango with the central AI that has made all these societal decisions, and that ultimately there is a bit CPU-like representation of the ideal human in that separate media.
Yeah, so sort of definition by, like a negative definition of humans, like these are the unacceptable genes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So you have the creation of a new layer, you could argue this, but you don't still have competition within the self-replicating new layer. So you don't have multiple AIs that are fighting against each other. It's just one central AI. But that's the defect of basically every science fiction scenario on genetic editing, is to not realize that eventually the modifiers will be competing among themselves.
So if we had Eastworld, it would be finished. That's what we need.
Exactly, because there were no iteration to give the chance to that AI to become better. Everyone conceives of the future big, mean AI machine as being a single thing, when in fact it's inevitable that it will be multiple things, each of them competing with one another.
Yeah, I think that reality might be more obvious in 100 years when the internet has collapsed into local fiefdoms, because they finally realized that the Alexa sitting in their house was collecting information that could be used against them by a large enough external enough entity.
Yeah, and there will be multiplicities of firewall and subroutines and subsystems that develop with more communication within than without.
Ripe ground for competing gene clinics.
Yes. I mean,
yeah, I've revolted against the smartphone fad. I got a flip phone again recently.
A flip phone?
Yeah.
So a phone that only calls and do you text?
No internet. Yeah, but I have to text like clicking the number 4 times.
Oh, yeah.
So to get the letter S or something like that.
That is extreme.
Yes. But it's good because that modern I interrupted you guys. You can keep talking.
No, that was a natural conclusion.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I thought it might be a natural conclusion. Okay. Yeah. So I went away from this, and the modern smartphone fad, it really pollutes your mind with constantly checking it. And I don't know if you guys can remember back at a time when you were younger, when you had a flip phone or before having a phone.
Yes. I mean, your mind
was allowed to wander.
Yeah, I've not had a flip phone ever. So I went from home phone, landline to touch phone.
Yeah.
But I've seen my really friends with it.
Yeah, it's a really peace of mind. And I still am able to listen to your show or audiobooks or podcasts because I can download them. And then my phone has a Bluetooth connection, and I can just Bluetooth connect to my headphones at work or something like that. And so listen to stuff I download through MP3 files. But so I get all the positive benefits that I ever want in a phone. And I don't know. I think people should do it again. And I think that with how Zoomers are they're in a way, they're becoming more the younger generations. Sure, they're very connected to technology, but they're becoming enclaves into certain different paths. And so I could see a path in the future where, well, I have to take my role as the optimist among the nihilists in the group here, and saying I could see a path for the future where people separate into so many different groups, where some people choose this, like where they accept all the technologies that benefit them but reject the ones that are toxic towards their mind, and develop more healthy lifestyles that way.
I think it's already happening. Just look at the friends I have lost from not being on Twitter. There's people I just don't talk to. They must think I'm dead as far as they're concerned. And yet we're on Discord, we're on Gab, and the people who went in these places, they still think of me as a man living. So I think it's already happening through the particular communities and platforms.
Yeah, I don't understand those people that when you get off YouTube or Twitter or whatever these social media, they just like, they think you've disappeared from the internet. They have no ability to keep you in their mind other than through a social media app. Yeah. Like they have a third party that only is your reference. And then they think, oh, JF's back from the dead every time you post on YouTube. Like these people are moronic idiots. Like, can't they look you up or remember that you said you're moving? These people are so connected to every social media notifying them about every little thing. They can't prioritize people in their life and then focus their life around that.
I use Firefox, so I don't know if other people are in the same boat, but there's probably an equivalent plugin to Unhook on Firefox, which is, it lets you hide aspects of the YouTube interface. So I have it set, so I can't see recommendations from YouTube. It won't show them at the end of the video. It won't show them at the side of the video. If I accidentally go to YouTube.com, it will automatically reroute me to my subscription feed. And yeah, so like I am immune to any sort of interference from Susan.
But yeah, the passivity of people is why there's a business base for Google. That's basically what Google, Facebook specialize in, is exploit that passivity and insert some opportunity for a publicity or for some mind control thing that they want to do. But what's the program you talked about, Fadam? $5?
Unhook.
Unhook. Okay.
Yeah, it's on Firefox. I don't know if there's a Chrome equivalent, but I assume there would be.
Oh, Firefox. Okay. That's what I was not understanding. Unhook, remove YouTube recommended videos comments. Yeah. Very good.
So I do like the podcasting platform, that type of media. It's very old school. You just upload it through MP3 and you download it, and it's just an audio recording. They have a set topic and they move on to it, and they can build upon that over months and years. Like there's certain podcasts where they have one topic and they've been on that same topic for about 10 years and they're still talking about it. And it's very unified. The thought process is that way. I mean, your show is a little bit more random and everything. And there's contributions from the community, which you've kind of innovated, which is interesting. But I also really admire that type of medium as well.
Yeah, I've not been watching much. I think there's a lack of stimulation to me. If I go on Spotify, I don't know how to find the stuff. I don't know how to get fascinated and in-depth on a given subject. I find a lot of things is superficial. But perhaps it's just a lack of guidance. Perhaps I would need someone to say, this show is high quality, watch it. But I've always been disappointed with podcasting. It's kind of trying to look good. It's often, you know, people who deliver superficial thoughts. It's never struck me as super important. Just Joe Rogan sometimes was doing good interviews, but even there, it's pretty diluted.
Yeah. The further you get away from blood sports, the lazier you'll get intellectually. Like if you truly have a one-directional flow of information, then you can pretty well say anything. And you will pass the popularity test by just accruing people that are happy to be in an environment where they don't have to be exposed to questions.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you can get big in internet blood sports, you've got something to say, or you've got a way of deriving intellectual commentary.
Yeah, ultimately, seen that way, Internet Blood Sports was kind of the natural selection filter of the podcast world.
Yeah, well, I guess we just have very different interests, because if it wasn't for your show, I would know nothing about the news, and I don't really follow scientific stuff. All I listen to is history and philosophy stuff all day long. And so,
oh, yeah.
That's the only thing, only stuff I consume. And so you don't really consume much history books or
no, it's too sleepy
time, so.
To me.
It's, yeah.
I would like to get excited at a big clash of history, but it's always too historical to, okay, here's a list of facts and dates about what happened. Never gives us insight. It's never human enough to me, you know?
Yeah. I just like it because you can really understand where you are in the current world, how every little factor led up to your current state of how you are. And the more you learn, just the more you see everything and all the connections about the world coming together. And it's a very long process. You read stuff every day and you just find connections and you get greater understandings about the world and you can make more informed decisions about how people were and how they are and how future societies can be built. Mm-hmm. But history is a very slow, and sometimes you'll read stuff for weeks and get no insights from it at all.
And I like,
I think I
go ahead,
I think on. I recommended Devin Stack's review of the Waco seed.
Oh, yeah,
before it, if I didn't, I recommend it again. It's quite slow, but you can what I do with his podcast is throw them into Audacity and remove the truncate the silence.
You do this? That is awesome.
Oh yeah, he's got a mode of speaking where he's got all these pregnant pauses in all of his sentences.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's fine just to like truncate it. But anyway, his review of the Waco Siege is at this point a historical event. It's 30 years ago, and I think it probably shapes the America around you more than a lot of other historical events in America.
I'm very interested. I will certainly watch this. I didn't know about it, but that seems like an important event.
There's this phrase he repeats a few times in the recap. It's the guy, it's the same people, because they have an interview there with one of the guys, and Devin Stacks is pointing out, you know, he's this guy and has a photo of him. He's the guy in the tank. He's the guy in this tank. He's the one that shoots incendiary rounds into the building and kills all the children in there. He's the guy. They're interviewing him. That's him. Here's a video of him doing donuts on the corpses of people buried outside of the Waco building. It's him. He's the guy. It's not another guy. It's not another person from the same department as him. It's not someone who is inspired by the ATF to do future oppressive actions or part of this like descent towards tyranny. No, it's him. He's the guy. He's still there. He's got a promotion since then. He no longer drives the tank. He instructs other people to drive the tanks. It's him. He's still there. It was blowing my mind when I was watching. It was like, holy shit.
Hi, are you talking about the cons from Devon? Great coverage of this. I don't know that it's the cons. What is the cons?
It's just a code word for the series that he's doing on PatCon.
Oh, okay.
on like the last 50 years of actions taken by various various right wing sort of like the historical usses, the people that have done what we've done and said 50 years ago, hey, this system is bad and not working.
Yeah,
we're going to move out into the countryside, and man, this government's going to fall any day now, and we need to be prepared and things like that. The people that did that 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. I'll certainly watch this.
Yeah, I'll grab you a link to it later.
All right.
One thing I've been thinking about lately is in my podcast, I recently learned that in, around the 15th century, 14th, 15th century in England, they started developing all the modern quotation and punctuation marks that we have today, like the comma, quotation, apostrophe. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things, they influence language and they influence how we construct language, because the Greeks, they pushed all of the words together. There was no spaces in mm-hmm. the writing. And they eventually, around the 4th century BC, developed a mark to say this is the end of a thought and this mm-hmm. is a new thought. But that's the farthest they went.
Okay.
And
sorry, when was the comma developed? I love the comma, so I'm very interested.
Around the 14th, 15th century in England. Yeah. And so it was developed, but it also was developed. They had a greater diversity in the comma. They had a comma with one dot very close to the comma. I might get this wrong, but signifying that the thought is quite similar to each other. And we kind of have this with the, what's that mark with the comma and there's a dot above it again? What is that called?
The semicolon.
Semicolon, yeah. And then there was one with, but we just have it, the comma with the dot. But they had comma with a close dot, a slightly higher up dot, or a far up dot. And mm-hmm. so there was greater variation. And so you could express a diversity of thought where this was a closely linked thought, slightly separated or more separated. And so you could show the varying degrees of how interrelated those thoughts are. And I feel like we could even develop more marks that signify other things that are unspoken, because there's a lot of things in writing that don't come across when we say, if I inflect my language in a certain way to signify a certain emphasis or certain relation of certain words and sounds, that I think they can be developed to just give greater meaning to language.
The internet came with slash s for sarcasm.
Yes. So even modern technology, yeah, like you have even innovated in a way in your book, The Revolutionary Phenotype, where you use internet slang in a scientific work, as you claim it to be. And I agree with you. It's a very highly reputable, extremely well thought out scientific work. But you treat it, you write it in almost some internet slang.
Yes.
And I admire that, because it shows a willingness to innovate in language. And maybe you weren't doing this because you're not a native English speaker and you couldn't write at like the highest level of maybe a person that was a native English speaker and then became an amazing writer because they're a native English speaker, and so you had to speak in this internet slang in a way.
I didn't have to. I chose that. In fact, there was a version of the book early that had much more internet slang, and at some point the correctors were like, "Jeff, you cannot be that much." Like, there was the word "poundage," and there was the word "quantage." It was all gaming wording. So I removed a lot of it, but much of it has transpired and stood there. And it's by choice. I could have decided that I used higher level English. But to me, that was the way that the idea came to my mind, and I wanted to drop it that way to people.
Because it gives us more information in a way. And when we use words that are highfalutin, like supposedly superior language, I mean, that just goes back to an older time where people would just insert French words because French was associated with the nobility. And so they would just insert French words in English just to appeal to making their argument seem more superior, when a native English word could have worked just as well. And so you're kind of like acting like the native English people in a way. We're just giving people their language as it currently is in the human dialect in the internet of the modern day, just straight to them without any superiority or any like scientific authority over them.
Absolutely. What is left of the internet lingo in TRP, though? I talk about computer gaming history. I use terms like the end with an N and a D.
Base, owning your dudes.
Owning your what?
I'm in your base, owning your dudes.
Oh, yeah. I'm in your phenotype. I'm in your phenotype, eradicating your life form.
I don't think people are going to get it in 1,000 years.
One of my favorite sentences of the book is that is really the part that moves me most, because it's like I tried to make the message for all of time, basically. I wanted both our society and societies of the future to receive that sentence in their heart. But I'm looking for it. Oh, yeah. So this is one of the passages that I want to echo as long as possible in human civilization. If one were to depict the rise of DNA through a social media meme, it would be a picture of a smiling fellow with menacing eyes saying to its RNA master, "I'm in your phenotype, eradicating your life form." And this is where I really like what comes. In the unlikely event that any life form on Earth ever starts truly caring about its own existence, it might pluck the following piece of wisdom from the ashes of the RNA world. If you're one of the most successful replicators on Earth, do not invent a machine that resembles yourself. It is so contrary to the instinct, because the instinct is, wait a minute, I want to make babies. I'm creating a baby that resembles myself. But this sentence is about a kind of baby you should never produce, a revolutionary phenotype. And I think this sentence could echo to even a revolutionary phenotype and could be carried forward. If anything from the book survives, it could be just these words.
Yeah. It's really at the... baby is a grug sort of word that would be one of the... it would be of the first 100 words you would invent, baby would be among them. So anything that retains a language and retains reproduction is going to be able to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I admire the way that you modify language in a way, because you get attacked, I've noticed, in some comments where, this is amateurish writing.
Yeah.
But that's literally what Shakespeare did, what Chaucer did, the most respected English writers. They invented words all the time. They couldn't come up with a concept that was already in the English language. So they would just invent a word by putting two words together, or just inventing it by the way it sounded or something like that.
Yeah.
And I've been just experimenting in this so much, because I've talked about wanting to write a book for years, and I'm just such a perfectionist that I'm experimenting with everything, and even I'm experimenting with different punctuation marks and different spellings for different things and different words. And so it's just, I think there's value in creating a new way of looking at the word, even through the grammatical lens in a way, because it'll give people a different frame of thought.
Absolutely. And I love the end, endy. I really like how it's basically a code word for an end, E-N-D. But when you look at the chapter title, chapter 12, the end of DNA, what I really like is you realize it's also the first letters of DNA inverted. So it's not just the end of DNA in terms of the finishing of DNA. It's the end of DNA in terms of the inversion of DNA becoming reverted against itself. I love how end does these two things.
Very nice. I like that.
All right, was there anything else you guys wanted to talk about tonight, Fadam? I think I may have interrupted you.
You didn't interrupt me, but I have... I talked to James about this, actually. What one annoyance I have sort of developed with the show probably over the last year. Hopefully I haven't talked about this before, stop me if I have, but the lack of a stance from which to criticize the world. I know that you do have a stance from which to criticize the world. It's the family-centered, reproduction-centered, evolution-centered view.
Yeah.
But I guess rather than a stance, the word I should have used is like project. Like a societal project, not a personal project or like a community project. Not even necessarily like to have a project, societal project that could actually be realized, like the Antarctica project, which was used as a sort of thought practice to point out, like, wouldn't it be okay if we went to Antarctica and we had an ethnic nation there? It sort of annoyed me in the same way that back when I was a young teenager watching Jon Stewart, his sort of comedy eventually chafed on me in that it was always from this position of the eternal critic. Mm-hmm. And like Jon Stewart was never going to say, the things you do in society are silly. They should be like X, Y, Z instead, because if we did my societal project, things would be better.
Yeah. But are you saying that I don't talk of societal projects anymore? Because it seems that when I say, but basically we need to restore marriage dynamics these things, I'm talking about a societal project. But are you saying I'm not explicitly framing it so that people understand that is what we should do?
Yeah, I know there are like points of contention and values, there's not like it's not a. I don't hear or see it as like a sort of laid out or like self-contained or how do I say this?
A holistic philosophy.
It is kind of a holistic philosophy.
He's not actively doing things that promote his philosophy in the show, like inviting people on to give the counseling for different marital advice and like giving that more active advice. It's just always the criticism.
No, and Jeff does do that as well. It's more that if you just look at liberal actions in the world and say that won't work and you should do something else. It's not, the something else isn't all like tethered together. Like we should restore marriage. We should have innocent before proven guilty. We should have we should dissolve racial preferences in the law and things like that. Like mm-hmm. all these points are good points and they're all tied together to a philosophy, but not to like a separate project that could actually work. Like distributist, he's sort of trying to speak and have ideas in this direction of like having an alternate societal project, and like at the moment he's talked about dating and how you would have societies that enforce a respect of both like women to be looking for marriageable men, but also men to be engaging in dating, to be expressing dating preferences that make that favor them to present themselves as marriageable men rather than to be players. And whether he's succeeding or not in this, like there is he's laying out his goal of this sort of Catholic Christian America, and like all of the social functions that you have to get right in order to reinstitute this this way of being.
I see. But, so basically, you would want maybe a constitution project or a tree of political philosophy that says, here are our principles and here's how it plays out on everything that JF talks about on an everyday basis.
Yeah, yeah. Like in that direction, because if you just say like, we need to like have marriage be like this, there's all of these like knock-on consequences, and you have that in contention with other rights. Like the one one thing that's really obvious is this sort of contorted position that I sort of share with the abortion stuff. It's like I don't really care about protecting other people's children. I kind of just want to punish people that kill children. Like I don't really care about your baby, but if you're a baby killer, you should be in jail.
Okay, very interesting. And so, I think it could add to my everyday show. I don't know what form it could take. Would it be something that I bring up by voice, or would it be a website? Would it be a new religion that we found? I don't know exactly. How do you see the form of this taking?
A religion or
basically a new term, a new philosophy, and we said that we are JFist, and we believe in ABC.
Yeah, I don't know what to call it. It would be like a society project, I suppose. Like not even like an actual one, but at least like a theoretical one, because I don't think this is a space for like actual useful societal project building. Like it's a small, very geographically separated cluster of people. But
it's very interesting. I really want to do something like this, like articulate everything around the NAP, like, and understand like, do we believe in the NAP at all costs, or do we think there's something wrong with the NAP, and how does it play out in contractual law and all of this? That's very interesting. I think I would like to make it happen, but I'll have to think about the form it takes. Is it a collective project, or is it just my system of belief?
Yeah, and like for libertarianism, like I like libertarianism and I think it's great, but it's like super, super self-destructive unless you have other like bounding principles.
Yeah.
And so for instance, like my magical libertarian society, if I could implement it, would die. And so the one that I would like to do instead of that would be something where the state was pretty well absolute at the border in terms of restricting commercial practices. So, and like prescient issue on that one is like Ukraine, like all this money you give to Ukraine, or are you at war with Ukraine now? What if I, a person in Australia, gave $50 billion of my personal money to Ukraine? Am I at war with Ukraine? Is Australia at war? Is Russia right to see Australia at war with Ukraine because I, a person, gave $50 billion to a country they're fighting?
Is it an act of aggression?
And is Australia now, and the other people around me, are they now responsible for Russia's war on me? Do they have an obligation to defend me?
Very interesting.
I would just say that you have the full, like you have the libertarian free market dream within this magical arbitrary border that the state has an absolute control over, and that's what like I would do to make libertarianism actually work within a local environment. But anyway, we're getting into
very
my,
interesting
answer.
But then we get into diplomacy and war is arbitrary, and there must be some kind of arbitrary power wielding going on there, or else it becomes exploitable. If it's already clear that you will never consider any sort of funding as an act of aggression because you didn't technically hurt me, then people are going to start funding revolutions around your borders and you're done.
Yeah. So like, rather than, like, if we have some right-wing Catholic movement like restoring Western civilization and they were implementing some kind of state, and they were restricting our rights to some degree, and they were taking actions on our behalf to manage inter-nation conflict. Like, I would hate to still be there throwing tomatoes at them and saying, no, you didn't respect the NAP or something like that. Yeah, like, there would have to be a point of compromise where you can say, like, it's broken, I don't like it, but I will accept it based on, like, X, Y, and Z reasons.
So that's wonderful. I may try to put down some thoughts and perhaps put them on arguably so that people can publicly see them and perhaps start structuring my system of belief, because everything you described there exists in my mind. And it's what drives my work every day. When I take position on something that leftists do today, it's based on a tree of logic that exists just in my mind. But it's a very good idea to be putting it explicitly.
Cool. That would be a great. It would be great to access that and be able to critique it.
Wonderful. So let's cut it for tonight. James, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, just with my vision of how I'd like to see the show, I would love to see you. You were very disagreeable in the past with a lot of guests and like inviting them on and then critiquing their worldview and those clashes of ideas and the meeting of minds between two alternative frame views of the world. Like, you have a very unique view of the world and you have a different person coming on. I think it would be interesting to see that more again, even if you have to invite very small people on that don't have many followers. I just love seeing you interact with people from a different worldview. I really like that.
Yeah, it's much harder to get guests when you have a small show, but I can try. I can try in some base of the internet of people who are willing to engage. I know that it was my bread and butter, and perhaps what I was doing best was to feature thoughts different from mine and then criticize and intervene and push these concepts to the maximum that they could handle it. It's very hard to do this, but I can try as much as I can. And I've been sending emails to people. People keep sending me, Jeff, can you invite this person or this person? I send the emails. But it's much harder to get them on the show because they have nothing to gain being watched by 1,000 people and potentially looking bad.
Oh, okay. So you have tried. Okay.
Yeah, I try. I try. But I mean, I don't try to the extent. I try when someone asks me, but I don't regularly try to get guests anymore. But when someone asks me and says, Jeff, I would really like you to invite this person, I send the invite, and sometimes it results in a guest show here or there, but I don't do it on a weekly basis, only on demand. But I can try seeing on Gab if there are people who, for whom there could be an intellectual clash, but most of the time it's going to be me criticizing and analyzing in a solo show, because clashes don't exist very much outside of the debate channels anymore. All right, guys. James, sorry. What were you about to say?
Yeah, you don't take full videos much anymore, and then analyze them piece by piece and critique their little parts. And it would be fun to see, because I remember you did like an 8-hour or something like that, a really long show on Jordan Peterson.
I did. But do these videos exist anymore? Because I criticize video when my day was filled with new videos that I could watch and that were stating things that I wanted to criticize. But are there intellectual videos anymore? Because I don't watch videos anymore. I don't feel like the world is intellectual anymore. I feel like everything is just a discussion with loose terms that are not super criticizable. It's like more consumable videos, but if you do have ideas of videos that are making positive statements and clear statements that can be criticized, debunked, or adhered to, I would love to go back to that style.
I mean, I can send it to you if I find it something, but I also feel like maybe you're becoming cognitively a bit more rigid, where you're a little bit less open to all of this stuff, and you're just in your own little.
I am, but have you watched a Kraut MT video these days? I mean,
no.
It's uncriticizable. It's just assumptions around, well, Nazis did this and did that, and they're evil. It doesn't say there's a pregnant trout anymore. There's nothing. People have learned to smooth out their language so that they don't really say anything important and anything criticizable.
Really? I just really watch your show, and I just consume like old historical stuff, so I'm not really informed on the internet subculture history, how it's transformed. It's really become no one's trying for truth anymore. It's all just maintaining their base, making money from it, but never saying anything important and doing that sort of stuff. It's gotten that bad.
So look at this crowd. So why Saudi Arabia is doomed?
This video is sponsored by Ground News. I highly recommend
this video is sponsored by Ground, blah blah blah. Ground now has official sponsor. And okay, he's gonna go on to make the argument that Saudi Arabia is doomed. How can I make a show about that? How can I make a show about no, Saudi Arabia is not doomed? It's so specific. Who would care about this case? I don't know what to do. And it's like that throughout the internet. And you can put it on my cognitive rigidity, which I'm sure is coming and is affecting me. But let's be clear, this is so uninteresting that it's not worth playing through it. I would bore my audience out with this kind of crap.
I'm not trying to attack you, but I'm just trying to explore all possibilities to why maybe you're not doing these things. So I was saying maybe a possibility is that you're just becoming cognitively rigid.
No, I don't feel attacked. I don't feel attacked at all. I know that I am cognitively rigid and that it's inevitable. I'm 38 years old. So have you ever heard of a genius at 38 years old that comes and changes the world and says something super intelligent? I never heard of this. I've heard of 23 years old, 25 years old, 27 years old, but I've never heard of a 38 years old who does anything else than repeat what they've been doing and trying to extend their engagement with the patterns that they've learned in young adulthood. So
I know what you mean. It sucks.
Correct.
It sucks. I just turned 30 and I'm already starting to feel more cognitively rigid. I'm not as always constantly challenging every little thing all the time.
But my point to you is I am cognitively rigid, but I can still do what I was doing 10 years ago, which is a full video review. I'm totally capable of this, but I just don't see a video worth reviewing. You watch a Jordan Peterson interview and it's all the same loops that he's always into. You watch a Kraut MT, it's a bizarre historical argument with Saudi Arabia. I have to have content that drags my audience and myself. It needs to be interesting enough for me to care. I don't know how to care about Saudi Arabia being doomed or not doomed.
What about philosophy? I feel like there's branches for growth in that. There's just go mainstream. I think you're looking constantly in the same patterns you've looked for years. These people, Kraut and T, Sargon, these normal people that you follow. What if you just look at new people posting philosophy videos on YouTube, doing some people you've never even talked about, never even watched their videos, and they're just going in from an academic standpoint, and they're talking about certain philosophers or different philosophies from a certain perspective, and you can undermine their presumptions based upon your worldview. And I feel like it would be totally different because you tend to go back to these people that you followed for years, and they've become dead ends. They're cucked. They don't talk about anything interesting. But maybe just try a new platform for reviewing videos and something you've never talked about before.
Yeah, I'm open, and I could explore the philosophy videos. The philosophy videos, the thing is, they're always self-consistent, and they're like these bubbles of self-evident truth. So I don't know if I can come up and say, I object to this, because as a moral nihilist, I ultimately see these videos and I'm like, okay, that's just your opinion, bro. But yeah, I could try to see if I disagree with anything in there or if something can lead to some questioning. All right, guys, thank you for your comments and thank you for joining us like always. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Good night, yep. Jeff.
See you next month.
And bye-bye to Shell, who was watching on the regular chat. And Mama JF, I'm sure, also was watching. Bye-bye, guys.